Welcome to Historically Thinking, a podcast about history and how to think about history. For more on this episode, go to historicallythinking.org, where you can find links and readings related to today's podcast, comment on the conversation, and sign up for our newsletter. And consider becoming a member of the Historically Thinking Common Room, a community of Patreon supporters. This episode of Historically Thinking was brought to you in part by a grant from the Greater Good Science Center of the University of California at Berkeley. For more about the Greater Good Science Center, go to ggsc.berkeley.edu. Hello, this is another of our conversations on intellectual humility and historical thinking. Today's guest is Mark Carnes. He is professor of history at Barnard College and executive director emeritus of the Reacting to the Past Consortium. His academic specialty is modern American history and historical pedagogy. Among his many books are Meanings for Manhood, Constructions of Masculinity in Victorian America, and Secret Ritual and Manhood in Victorian America, both of which I have referred to at numerous times on this podcast. An interest in how history appears in things other than histories led him to edit Past Imperfect, History According to the Movies, and Novel History, Historians and Novelists Confront America's Past and Each Other, both of which, I have to say, have a dazzlingly impressive array of contributors. In 1995, Mark Carnes pioneered a new pedagogy, a role-playing pedagogy, now known as Reacting to the Past, which placed students and their efforts to understand the past in the center of the classroom experience. He has written several games in the Reacting to the Past series, as well as Minds on Fire, How Role Immersion Games Transform College, which he and I discussed way back in episode 16, when the Earth was still young. As is always the case with these conversations, unlike more typical conversations on the podcast, we will follow a set format of questions, though in this case, we are going to wander off, or to tell you right now that we are going to wander off from the set path a little bit more than normal. Mark, thank you for joining us once again on Historically Thinking.
Well, thank you for that lovely and extravagant introduction. I appreciate that.
No,
that
I did very not kind. Say that you were the greatest scholar since Einstein, no,
but,
or that.
You but know, you left all the bad stuff out. Yeah, so I thanks.
It wasn't on your. It's not on the Barnard College website. So, let's begin with setting in the usual sort of setup questions that I ask. How did you first come to like history?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, I suppose it's I grew up. My father was with the Penny Company early on, with J.C. Penny Company, and the J.C. Penny Company began in the Midwest and it moved eastward, and we moved all the time. And he was then, when I was a teenager, moved to Newburgh, which was an urban place that was at that time in the throes of urban renewal. And as a kid who had sort of moved around and lived in suburban places, now I was living in an urban place that was where the core of it was being demolished. And I suppose I longed for a rootedness, but walking down the sort of rubbled streets where you'd kick across some concrete and you'd find the signs for a shoe store and, you know, embedded in the mosaic, I became attracted to the puzzle of this very complex 19th century industrial city that had had hard times. And I then went into urban history. Even in high school, I was interested in the new social history and sought out people like Clyde Griffin and Stuart Blumen when I was an undergraduate. And so I resolved to be a sort of a second generation new social historian, but then career went in strange and unusual directions, as do most, I suppose.
So even when you were a brand new freshman, you were interested in getting a doctorate? Was it at that stage?
Oh, no, I was interested in history. I don't think I didn't plan on a career in academia. I was an indifferent student in college, except that I enjoyed research papers. And so though I skipped most of my classes, I plunged into research and I enjoyed the research and I enjoyed writing and did well. So, But I had done sort of an exhausting senior year with a big senior thesis, and I took a couple of years off, and then I decided I missed academia at that point. And I at that point knew what I wanted to do. So when I went to graduate school, I had a focus that allowed me to complete the degree pretty quickly. So at the point, I sort of knew, I had a hunch as an undergraduate that I liked writing and research. And then I missed it greatly when I took the couple of years off. So at that point, I knew.
Mm-hmm. So many of your, I mentioned two of your books, three of your books, all of which, I think when we talked back in episode 16, I was talking to you about the connections between your research on manhood rituals and secret societies, and then, and we'll talk about reacting to the past and immersion role-playing, and sort of your sociology of the undergraduate life, which is kind of informs reacting to the past, with which I totally subscribe, having, you know, watched them with the fascination of a large animal biologist at an African waterhole. How did you get on that track of, because you've done various different, you've actually done a remarkably number of different things, but how did you get on this track? First of all, you had said you were a second generation social historian, if I could copy that down correctly. And some of the listeners will wonder, well, what in the world is that?
Well, the I don't know if there was a second generation of the new social historians. They fragmented many different directions, yeah. And
infanticide was involved, I'm afraid.
Yeah, exactly. But this the first generation were people who were trying to look at history from the bottom up, was the phrase. Instead of studying presidents, you would get into census schedules and reconstruct communities and try to figure out how people who didn't leave a clear voice in the past, how they then, what their lives consisted of and what their lives meant. And it was very much attached to community studies. And as someone who was interested in that, in the Newburgh community, that it had such a difficult evolution, that's where I was going. I wanted to extend their work. And so I first was thinking as a graduate student of going into economic history. But then I sort of moved around and ended up sort of stumbling into gender, just because I was, after walking in Widener Library at Harvard as an undergraduate, looking in the stacks, I came across these big books of there were exposés of rituals of secret societies like the Odd Fellows and the Knights of Pythias, and I looked at what these rituals were, and they were long and complex and bizarre. And I couldn't understand them. I put it aside when I decided to go into economic history. But I couldn't understand why most middle class American men in the late 19th century spent much of their time and money on these organizations. So that's why I came back to that, just out of curiosity that I couldn't figure it out. Right. So that led to Secret Ritual and Manhood in Victorian America.
You were perplexed. You were perplexed by what was in front of you, and those. So therefore, you had to solve that.
And eventually, that took me to gender history, which was not, you know, it was not my intent, but that's my journey took me there.
Mm-hmm. You wrote that to me when we were talking over this interview and emailing about it. You said that I think that every real scholar and scientist begins a research project with some sort of underlying premise and assumption. But from what I've seen in historical research, reality is always more complicated than our capacity to explain it. Did that happen to you when you were working on these sort of rituals of Victorian manhood?
Yeah, I think it's happened in maybe it's just I'm not that clever, But every interesting historical issue that I've encountered has been perplexing, and I always end up generating a hypothesis to explain it, and they're never right. So once you start getting into the research, and maybe this is why I like the research, is that if you go to the research looking to confirm your position, you end up having boring stuff. But if you let the research take you, open yourself up to it, it will take you places that are perplexing and complicated that you didn't expect. And to me, that's a revelation and it's a joy. Yeah. And solving that puzzle, what does this complexity that the research is opening up that I didn't imagine, what does that mean? That to me is the joy of historical discovery. If you know where you're going, then you're either a hell of a lot smarter than anyone I've known, or you're just not doing real research and you're not opening yourself up to the complexity.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. Some people who have declined to be on this podcast have written polite emails, not expressing that point of view. But when you were talking, I reminded something my supervisor said about when he was talking about going with the grain of the Bodleian Library. And I think going with the grain of the archive, I've now thought of as kind of a rich metaphor. It's complex. It's multivalent. There's a way he was referring to the way that every archive is set up by different people. Different people give things to it. And so there's always a way in any archive or any library is composed. It's inescapable. But there's also a way in which when you go with the grain, you're letting it take you. You're following the resources that you have to go where they want to go rather than where you want to go. And sometimes you'll run into a knot. We could keep on doing this metaphor indefinitely. To go with the grain of an archive, to go with the grain of sources means that you're going to, it's not always your will. In fact, it's never your will that wins. It's the evidence, the accumulated evidence has to win.
But what I say to my students is that though your sources will take you in complex places, you will find one path through them because your brain works in a particular way and your experience have influenced your brain in a particular way. And you will see things in the sources that somebody else won't see. So while the sources, there may be a grain to them, each person will have a different grain. And so that they will always be fresh. They always speak to new generations and new people in a different way, which is why, history is so much fun, especially if you keep your primary sources as your triggering your font of ideas. I mean, I think too often we get so caught up in the secondary source debates that we lose the capacity to see the historical materials in a fresh way.
So we wanted to focus in this conversation on, I guess, probably looking back, certainly Mark Carnes in 1982 would be surprised at Mark Carnes. What happened to Mark Carnes in 1995? You had a rather sudden shift, or a rather big change your mind moment, because that's the year. That's what it says on all the websites where you started to develop this thing that's now called reacting to the past. Before we explain what it's become, let's describe that moment. And let me know. I think as I said to you before we began recording, there are probably lots of historians who've changed their mind, even if they don't want to admit it. There are some historians who have actually sort of publicly refuted earlier work or written a book, which, says, what I said 20, 30 years ago, I was young and ignorant and stupid, and I just wasn't, appreciating the people for what they were, et cetera, et cetera. But among them, but some of the things that were most conservative is too mild, reactionary about is the way we teach. Because, damn it, we were taught that way from kindergarten through 3 years of grad school. And it's too late to stop now. It's been ingrained in us. It's in us like the grain of wood. Can you describe that sort of moment of change, your Damascus moment in the classroom?
I remember very, very clearly in that I had I'd gotten tenure at Columbia. I had chaired the Barnard History Department. I mean, fairly recently, I'd I'd been with John Garrity, the general editor of the American National Biography, which was a big project. And I felt that I was a good teacher. I was teaching at a school with outstanding students. And I was teaching a first-year seminar, which was on great books. So I was a good teacher. My students were superb. And I'm dealing with the masterpieces of the human imagination. And I'm dreading going to class because it's going to be so boring. And I remember walking across the courtyard to go to class, and I was late. And I knew I should hurry up, but I couldn't push myself ahead because I just dreaded the boring class. And I remember I got to the classroom. All the students were on one side of the table. I was on another. I asked a question, and it was boring. And I didn't understand it. There was a certain arrogance that I shouldn't have a boring class under these conditions, these perfect conditions. It wasn't even a big lecture class. So I invited the students in that class individually to meet with me the next semester to figure out what had gone wrong. So this is the second moment. The first moment is that sense of just dread for the class.
Let me just point out that feeling of dread is common to professors in how many higher educational institutions are there in America? Like 2,200 four-year institutions. Maybe that counts two-year institutions. So they all feel it. But what I love about you, your situation is you couldn't pretend it. You couldn't blame it on the kids.
No, I couldn't.
At IU South Bend or Penn State, Lower Shipshawana.
It was
they can say it's my students. Yeah.
It was the ideal teaching situation. A seminar with first-year students, with a veteran teacher who finally knew the big texts he was teaching, and you're dealing with the masterpieces of the human imagination. It was just, there was no excuse for it. So that was the first moment, this moment of just alarm. The second moment was, I invited all the students to meet with me individually to see what had gone wrong the next semester. And most of the students came in to see me. And this one student came in to see me, and we started talking. And she was puzzled as to why she was there. She said that the class had been her favorite class. And I said, how can that be? I was bored. You were bored. You could feel the boredom in the room. And she looked up my books. She pondered. She said, well, yes. But all classes are sort of boring. Yours was less boring than most. And that just was the flash of cognition from my experience as an undergraduate at Harvard. They were all sort of boring. And that shouldn't be, okay? If I had been maybe a more diligent student, and again, I wasn't a bad student in that I threw myself into research, but the structure of classes was sort of boring for me at best, and sometimes it was excruciatingly boring, and I skipped many of them. So I then decided I was going to shake up this seminar and create a sort of game debate structure. And in one of these debates that was set in Ming China, the students who had the role of first Grand Secretary and Emperor took the game away from me. They sort of pulled it away. They started running the game, and I let them do that just because I didn't know what else to do. And when they started running the game and the class, the whole class dynamics changed in a fundamental way. That the students became more engaged, they became more attuned to each other, and a dynamic. And I know you've taught in reacting classes that's really quite inexplicable occurs where they're feeding off each other's energy, off each other's egos, and there are these real complex interactions. Some of them competitive, some of them affiliative. Just a strange mix. But the cast suddenly had energy. And for the first of these classes, I would sort of intervene and offer my own opinions. And I realized when I intervened, I got in the way and was screwing up this interesting emotional dynamic that was energizing the class. So I moved my chair away from the table. Then I eventually moved to the back of the room, and the students didn't notice I wasn't there. And that led to a conundrum, which was, there is some pedagogical magic in that room, but the students don't know the material. So I would be helping them after class and nudging them towards readings and strategies and ideas, and they would voraciously gobble it up and energize the next class. So it occurred to me that if we could create structures, game structures that students could habit where the could inhabit, where the content was embedded in the structure, say this mansion, and the architecture has the content, and the each room is carrying the content, and then you push students into the structure, they'll learn the content while exploring it themselves, and if the game dynamic is what's driving them forward, they'll acquire the content, but they also acquire all of these skills in this dynamic way. And that and I didn't figure all this out in the way I'm describing. This took years for me to sort of understand this process. But what was clear right from the start was there's something magical about a structure where students were running the class in this game type form. Explaining that became the puzzle. Mm-hmm. Another puzzle was, it was so obvious, and I'm sure I don't know how, I know you started teaching reacting, but it starts working really quickly.
It starts working insanely quickly. I would say by the end of the second class, they're off.
And that
doesn't depend on the game. I was teaching an American Revolution unit. And I, most of my approach to pedagogy was based on sort of the self-knowledge that I'm a ham, and that I had tried to, that what I thought was good teaching and why my students liked my teaching was that I overwhelmed them with personality. And at some point, it's probably from, you know, Lendell Calder, convinced me that this was not actually teaching, but I kind of knew that already, you know, and I in my endless self-examinations, which go on for far too long. And I wasn't really teaching, I was performing. And so when I think by Lendell or someone, I found out about reacting, I tried it out and decided to try it out in the class where I was most confident, which was in what, you know, I know the most about, which is the American Revolution. It's my subject. So I would because I knew that I would, in the American Revolution, I would rattle on about the social economic composition of the 1st Maryland Regiment, you know, from 1775 to 1783. I could talk about, you know, cane breaks and their importance in the backcountry, you know, cattle feeding, the habits of cattle and how that clashes with Cherokee and Creek sovereignty. You know, I could really let myself go.
And it's important.
Yeah, it's not.
But it's important to you, and you mastered
it. It was important to me because I knew that accumulating a number of facts was not the same thing as teaching. That I had learned already. So I decided that I would use two games. I would use the really wonderful American Revolution game that's set in New York City, from 1773 to 75. And then I would finish that off. I would finish off the era by doing the Constitution game, which was then in development. And it was a blast. These bunch of Midwesterners, mostly from Chicagoland, you know, who are taught to not think about, hate New York and believe Chicago is the finest city in the world. They knew a lot about colonial New York. I mean, they knew it's one of the weird things that you find that they know about things. They began to know the geography of colonial New York. I mean, who does that other than a very specific historians? But they knew where Golden Hill was in relation to the, you know, King's College versus the First Broad. I mean, it's just kind of crazy. But by the time we got the Constitutional Convention, then they were committed. They were addicts to this process. And, you know, as I often say, they all had a copy of Madison's notes on the Constitutional Convention. And I've got a couple copies around here, and they're much less dog-eared and have fewer post-its in it than theirs did. They were thumbing through that, like, you know, fundamentalists through their King James Bible at a Kentucky revival. And they knew from Madison, they knew their role. They knew what they were supposed to say. And more than that, they were, and this is sort of a point you made in our email correspondence, they were having to think differently. They were having to think like a radical anti-federalist from Maryland, Luther Martin. They were having to think like the Rutledges, Rutledge from South Carolina. Some of them had to, much to their discomfort, this is 2015, 2016, they had to articulate the first intimations of the argument of slavery as a positive good, which, you know, to my mind, really comes out in the Constitutional Convention first. At the same time, they have to, some of them are, one of them is Rufus King, who's an abolitionist, but a nosebleedingly high federalist who kind of wants an actual titled aristocracy, you know, and on and on and on. The people that get selected these, they selected these roles randomly, but eventually they have to be them, and they're committed to that different way of looking, which is one of the most fascinating, the weird psychological things that goes on in a reacting game, I think.
What puzzled me, and this happened with, you're talking about your students who were thrown into these really good games that Bill Offutt had designed, the American Revolution game, and Pat Kobe designed the Constitutional Convention game. And both of them are sort of game design geniuses. They didn't know it. Yeah. They're just regular historians and political scientists.
And I should say, I've used the First Crusade game, which was excellent. That was an excellent thing for a medieval class. And I've used yeah, at some point when I was teaching, I loved teaching first year inquiry at Augustana. So I would, you know, teach a writing section first term in a trimester. And I resolved I will never teach second term again without using a reacting game, because it got them into contact with texts in the way that nothing else in the first year experience could. Much like your experience in 1995. And so I taught Josh Ober's splendid Athenian game, which was best experiences I think I had teaching, doing, and reacting.
So what? But the early version of that game, I wrote the early version of the Athens game in 1996, and then Josh Ober in 1998 said, "No, you've got it all wrong." And he suggested he gave me the design for reshaping that game, But the games worked even when they weren't carefully designed, elaborate structures. They weren't as good. They weren't intellectually as solid. But as a pedagogical experience, they were good even when they were thin and incomplete. So what then puzzled me was that everybody, not just about everybody I spoke with, had this who adopted reacting, and reacting spread by word of mouth, and different professors started doing it, and I got feedback such as yours from people who said it wasn't that my classes became better; it's just they became glorious in a way that having motivated students going off doing fascinating and fun and intriguing things in the was a joy. And so the question was, they're doing this before we've invented the structure of the good games that you played with your students. Why the hell hadn't this been done before? Why, and that became the sort of the puzzle that I chewed on for a long time, because it seemed obvious. In fact, I just thought it was neglect, and I talked with scores of professors who when I first was promoting reacting to different faculty events, and probably 60 or 70 professors came up to me at one point and said, "You know, I tried something like this." And I always ask, "Did it work?" And they always said yes, but they didn't take it this far, that they had enough stuff to do one class session or two class sessions. The idea of creating a 250-page or 500-page game just didn't occur to them. So yes, we took it further, and so I began to write my book, Minds on Fire, with this idea. I just gathered together the stories such as yours and all of these other professors who had these glorious stories of how their classes didn't just become better, but became something entirely different and glorious and stimulating and fun for the instructors too. So I had all of these anecdotes, and that would be my book. And then I decided I'd have these anecdotes, and then I'd connect it to the titans of educational theory, Plato, Rousseau, John Dewey, Eric Erickson, all of whom said play was the best way to learn. So we've got this play form. It's really working in a dramatic way. And I've heard all the examples. And then why? Well, this is what the titans of history of philosophy, of educational philosophy, have said we should be doing. We should be doing playing. So that was the book. As all said, it would be easy to write. The problem was that when I read Plato more carefully, Plato says, we should play, but we should play through throwing spears and having races and martial sort of exercises. You should never take on imaginative roles as is done in the theater. You don't want shoemakers to imagine that they're gods and heroes and things like that, such as they get from going to Homer and watching plays. This infects their sense of self with delusions of grandeur and imaginative fantasies, and it screws up their self and gives and permeates it with falsehood. Then I read Rousseau, and Rousseau says the key thing in Emile and raising Emile is to keep him away from books where he will acquire some other ideas, or from other people who will infect their ideas. You keep him isolated. You especially don't want him so that he will act like somebody else. He has to, your job as your tutor is to keep him insulated from anyone else. You don't, if he ever imagines from reading a book that he is Caesar or he is Hannibal or some sort of, then he's been screwed up. You keep him unto himself. Dewey, this apostle of play, well, he's trying to get the industrial masses of America, the immigrants of America, ready for their jobs in industry. So he says, what do? You should give girls brooms and give boys shovels. They can play at that. He once gave a talk to a group of parents in Chicago, and he said, you want to encourage your kids to play, but they can play by doing jobs. Like, I found that washing dishes can be fun.
Yeah. He'd say that.
so the point is that these people were saying play, but they're defining plays and play in ways that were avoiding a make believe and taking on a role, because that diminished your authentic self, and they're taking fun out of it. And what I basically began to understand that fun has this subversive element that Plato understood and was wary of. And that these philosophers of education were trying to avoid the fun aspects of play, which have this element of imagination, which is inherently very, very dangerous, and of imagining yourself as different sorts of people, even people who are inappropriate or powerful. And as your kid, you shouldn't be powerful.
Yeah, yeah.
So what reacting did, I realized, was provided the sort of play that these educational philosophers disapproved of. And that's one reason why the play that they had advocated and the education schools still teach ends up failing, because it isn't any fun. And so generation after generation of teachers who have learned that they should do little playthings, and they do these little games that aren't any fun, they fail, and then they just get back to doing what they'd always done before. It doesn't work very well, and the really good ones will come up with the sort of personal performances that keep the classes in stitches, but may not teach all that much, but it keeps them awake. And we've fail to really explore the real power of play, which is to come up with play forms that are fun. And what happened upon in this reacting structure, a play form that's fun. Now, I'm sorry, I've given a lecture in defense of a play form that's anti-lecture. So forgive me.
Well, that's kind of like Plato. It's very paradoxical. Maybe you meant it, maybe you didn't. Reacting's been around now since when did you first start your the conferences first, or your when did you start the samizdat of these games that got distributed around?
So I got after the first year of where I created the first games, and I realized, and these games were in fields that I wasn't a specialist. Mm-hmm. I applied for a grant from FIPSI to bring in specialist scholars to improve these games, and the FIPSI said, "Yes, you can do it, but you got to then." They gave me the money. And then when the money was out and the grant was coming to an end, the program officer said, "What are you going to do for dissemination?" I said, what's dissemination? He says, "Well, you've got to invite in other people and show them what you've done. And, you know, that's the whole purpose of FIPSI is to come up with new ideas." And so we ran this first conference in 2001.
Okay. So and it hasn't, In many ways, it's been wildly successful. In other ways, you know, you've changed publishers a couple times. And for the reacting games, I just noted that UNC is now publishing them. And for enthusiasts like myself, even though I'm not in the classroom anymore, we really wish that this was like 10 times successful. And so I'm very curious, before we get on to sort of intellectual humility as inculcated by the game itself, I'm just curious about how people have pushed back. What's sort of the criticism that you've received about reacting? What don't people like about it, or what don't they think they like about it?
Do you know, there are lots of arguments against reacting, and Plato's is a good one that it's false. It has people being untrue to themselves. I think that's really a fundamental civilizational idea that's deeply embedded, that we need to be authentic to ourselves. There is an authentic self, and especially in Western civilization, and that playing is risible for adults. It's okay for kids, but kids will outgrow it. And Freud pretty much makes that point, that make-believe play is okay for kids, but when you have a real self, you will outgrow this imaginative space. So I think there's a fundamental undercurrent that's deeply embedded in the civilization that make-believe for adults is bad. And of course, what Hollywood and the media has discovered is that adults just love make-believe and are desperate for it. So the falsity of that premise is fascinating. So the other argument is that you come to college, especially to work, and to turn the class to play is appalling. And then you say, but are your students working? And they'll say 10% are. And those are the students that matter. The students, if they're not willing to work, they don't have the internal discipline to work, they shouldn't be in college. And so they teach for those 10%.
Yeah. I think this is my attitude probably before I taught a reacting class, I probably thought, you know, I spent years learning all this stuff, and damn it, now you're going to get it good and hard. Everything I shoved into my skull is going to be shoved into yours. And this is demeaning that I would step out of the class, that I would take a seat in the back, you know, and do this is ridiculous. Now, that is was a completely false apprehension of reacting. I might be sitting at the back of the room, but like the duck, I might be placid and still during the class, but my legs are paddling furiously and meeting with students and coaching them in the office hours and that sort of thing in order to help them improve or find this other fact in a book about, you know, smuggling in Revolutionary era New York City to aid their case or not aid their, you know, or to not aid their case and so on. So it actually, it wasn't demeaning at all, but that was kind of how I thought about it. And I'm sure lots of people who basically what we've got in academia is the pride of having gotten a PhD. It's not the salary. We've got that status. And I think that it I'm afraid that reacting hits a lot of people in their status anxiety.
And part of it is a big part of it is an inbred conservatism that if these intellectual arguments were more fervently held or more seriously held, people would be willing to come to reacting classes to take it on. But when I talk to a skeptic, I say, well, why don't you visit a class? Mm-hmm. And other faculty at hundreds of schools make the same pitch to their deans, to their colleagues. They say, just come to a class and see. And virtually always the most of the faculty won't do it. Mm-hmm. That they will suspect that it'll be an embarrassing dog and pony show, or that it is just absurd on the face of it. That here we are in a profession that exalts learning, and yet we adhere to tradition with a religious fervor. You know, it's what our sainted mentor did. What can be wrong with it? If only people were more willing to just even visit a class, then those who visit a class are unnerved by it. They may be, it's not for me. I know what I'm going to do. I've got my performances down right and they work well.
I wrote my notes. I can keep on reading them for another 30 years.
Yeah. I don't quite understand this game. It's the game book is 80,000 words and then the rolls are another 150,000 words. And I'd have to plunge myself into all of this other stuff, and I'm not sure it's going to work. I don't think it will, but it's really weird that it worked in this guy's class. There's lots of reasons why pedagogy has probably been the most conservative social cultural form imaginable in Western civilization. And it's not just the United States. The same thing is true in most European countries too.
With times three and with bells on.
Yes. Denmark is an exception. Norway is an exception. But other than that, it's very conservative.
The tutorial lecture system at Oxford has been going on for some time. And certainly the lecture part approximately since 1150. The tutorial is a relatively recent innovation of the 1880s. But there's previous antecedents to that. So that's, I would call that not just conservative, but downright reactionary. Yeah. Let's finish up. We're going way over our usual time, but this is just too enjoyable to stop.
And again, I've been lecturing in support of an anti-lecture pedagogist.
So. You gave me an example of how, by forcing students to think differently, the game reacting induces a fundamental intellectual humility. And you said a few years ago, a student of mine, while playing the reacting game, The Trial of Galileo, was assigned to play the role of Gaspar de Borja, a cardinal in the Holy Office of 1616. And de Borja opposed Galileo and Copernicanism. And afterwards, the student offered the following reflection on the experience. I'll read this, and then I'd like you to develop this. My character, student wrote, had to argue a position that I know to be erroneous, that the earth does not move. I learned that even when arguments such as this sound insane today, in their time, there is perfectly reasonable scientific, and they put quotes around scientific, but maybe we shouldn't. We just say scientific evidence and proofs to support these claims. This showed me how the way of seeing the world and of thinking has changed since then, and how it's important when looking back in history to be respectful and to recognize that truth evolves. It teaches us that we too can be wrong today, and that people in the future may laugh at our current beliefs, progress and scientific advancement demand open-mindedness. I have to say that if you got a note from that, from any student after a series of lectures, you would probably, even if you're an atheist, you would get down on your knees and thank someone, no one in particular, just for having had that little note of grace in your year, let alone your day. So could you develop that? Because I think it's essential to what we're talking about in this series.
It's we've grown up with a set of ideas that have been stuck in our heads, or that we've acquired and that we've nurtured and we've self-confirmed endlessly, and it makes sense. But it's limiting, and education is going beyond who and what you are now. It is not just acquiring more information, although it's going to be hard to acquire information that deeply goes into your self system that's contradictory to that self system. Your self system is going to tend to reject things that don't reaffirm who you are and who you think you are. So then how do you educate yourself? But what happens with reacting and is that students, in taking on a different role, they get ideas that don't fit with their self system. And but they're creating a fictive self system in their heads, that they're imagining they're somebody else, and the ideas around that make sense. The student who's playing the conservative cardinal is making an argument that the earth does not move. It's not Borja's argument, it's the argument of Aristotle. It's a brilliant argument that lasted 1,000 years, not because people were stupid, but because Aristotle's argument was simply irrefutable, that he proved incontrovertibly that the earth does not move and that the earth is not the center of the universe. And the argument was for 1,000 years incontrovertible. It really isn't until Galileo has his telescope and can see the moons of Saturn that he can show that the Earth is making a revolution around the Sun, and that is an argument. But the point being that the student is, in taking this argument and internalizing Aristotle's argument and playing the role of de Borgia as this conservative person who's looking at Galileo before Galileo has discovered those moons. Actually, it's the moons of Venus that
Jupiter.
That make the is it Venus. Jupiter? Okay,
yeah, Venus has no moons.
Okay, there we go. Thank you. that. The student realizes that if you can have an argument that's antithetical to your self system, to what you believe, that's antithetical to the truth, but is fully persuasive, then maybe you should look at the truths that are in your head and other people's heads a little bit more skeptically. And that happens. I'm sure that happened with your students in the Constitutional Convention game, who are taking on all these roles that are antithetical to what they believe, but they found that there was, in their context, plausibility in what they were saying.
Mm-hmm. Which is
which was why the debates ended up having so much energy. They could argue passionately for things that, in their real self, were nonsensical. I think that this is a pedagogy that teaches the sort of intellectual humility that we need. It was sort of espoused by R.G. Collingwood in the mid-20th century. He said that historians should embed themselves in the material they're studying, should reconstruct the context of the material, and then should use their imagination to try to think as historical actors did then. But there was a strong revulsion to Collingwood's idea, and that I think that has prevailed. And the revulsion is, well, so you want historians to become Attila the Hun and go ravage the world, and then they'll be historians. But what has sort of happened is that people students and others will take a contemporary perspective and say, okay, we'll look at Jefferson, and my God, here's someone who owned slaves, and this provides the lens for understanding Jefferson. Rather than the Collingwood approach, which is let's imagine ourselves in Jefferson's world as best we can, let's thicken our that world, and then throw ourselves and imagine it and approach it from the inside out. That's not done, at least not consciously, in the historical profession very often. I think it's unconsciously quite common. But what reacting does is it takes that approach to historical understanding of putting yourself in the shoes of historical figures and trying to understand why they did what they did. And I think that's an empathetic approach that we need more of in certainly understanding history, and probably more generally in life, you know, certainly in public discourse.
My guest today has been Mark Carnes. He is professor of history at Barnard College and executive director emeritus of the Reacting to the Past Consortium. Mark, as always, thank you for being part of Historically Thinking.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And thanks so much to you as well for being part of Historically Thinking. If you like the podcast, you can, of course, give us a review on the podcast platform of your choice. But by far the best way of helping us out is to share the podcast with a friend or with many friends. George McDonough is our producer. John Rutta is our sound engineer. I'm Al Zambone, and I'll be back with more history to think about and to shape the way we think about the present.